Hey, Chris.
Hey Tim, how are you?
You know, it's fine. It's fine. We'll just leave it at that. Hey, guess what? We're not doing Hall of Songs. We're doing Hall of Albums today.
Ooh, that sounds like a very special episode.
Yeah, I think I mentioned Hall of Albums in a previous episode. I think it was the episode we talked about albums. It was like 66 or something. So here we are. We're actually going to do a whole episode on albums. So get ready for an entirely different conversation.
That'll be fun. Do we at least get to keep the same theme song?
Yes, why not?
Okay.
Sisters are sifting through the vinyls at the record store. The Clash, Black Flag, Misfits, Ramones. I'm ready, ready, ready for my favorite show. Songs podcast, it's time to go. Hall of Songs, Hall of Songs, Hall of Songs.
Welcome, music lovers and loyal listeners, to Hall of Songs, Hall of Albums. It's Hall of Albums. Now, this is the podcast in which two men attempt to determine the greatest songs of all time. I am Tim Malcolm.
I am Chris Jones.
I did say Hall of Albums off the top, but that's what we're doing today. We're talking albums. It's a very special bonus episode of Hall of Songs. If you're coming in blind and have no idea what we're doing, really quick, we are the podcast that again determines the greatest songs of all time. We started in 1951 and we go year by year. We're now in 1972 is our next main episode coming up. And we nominate songs, the best songs from each year. And then what we ask you to do as a listener is to go to our website, hallofsongs.com. To vote for the songs that you think out of those songs belong in our Hall of Fame for songs called the Hall of Songs. You got it. I hope you do. If not, go to our website and just find it out, hallofsongs.com. This is our bonus episode where we're doing albums. Very different, very weird. And it's all about the radio station that kind of got us here in the first place, WXPN in Philadelphia. They did a thing last year, which kind of started this whole thing called the 2020 song. Is it 2020 greatest songs of all time? Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, they did the 2020 greatest songs of all time last year. And now this year they're going to do the 2021 greatest albums of all time, which is updating. The last time they did this, I know, and I actually looked it up not too long ago, right after I moved to Philadelphia. So it was the end of 2005. They did the 885 greatest albums of all time. So it's been a while, 16 years. But it should be fun. The songs countdown was great. I'm sure the albums countdown will as well.
Yeah, we're really excited for it. It starts on December 2nd, which I think this will be out after it starts. So we'll be in the middle of it somewhere. And so you can listen along with what we're going to do here. And Chris will explain what we're going to do in a moment. You'll listen along and you can play along with us. And it'll be a good companion piece to that. So this is what this episode is all about. And it is a bonus episode, and we don't like to do things alone all the time. So we have a special guest for this episode. Chris, why don't you introduce our guest?
All right. So we are joined by my friend, Ted Kurth. I've mentioned him, I think, once or twice on the pod, maybe in passing. But he has been a part of the show, at least on my end, since really we got started. I frequently run things by him and say, you know, we got two songs by this artist on the list. You know, should we keep them both? What do you think? And he's always been very frank, tries to set aside his own biases and give me, you know, a gut reaction that I think has been a really good check for us in winnowing down our list. So, Ted, welcome to Hall of Songs / Hall of Albums.
Thanks, guys. I'm excited to be a part of it.
All right. So I think we're going to do things a little bit different, if it's okay, for this one. What we're going to do is we have all, the three of us, cast a vote for our 10 favorite albums of all time. We're going to go through quickly and let you guys know what we voted for. We then have a very special Hall of Songs official ballot, which we cast, which Ted has not seen. He doesn't know what's on that. Tim and I, you know, spent some time, largely when I was quarantined in Portugal, I guess, coming up with our official 10 albums for the Hall of Songs. So we have an official list. So we're going to spend some time going through that. And we'll use that as a way of talking about our own personal preferences, you know, just ways of thinking about like the albums that we love. And how, you know, just sort of our reaction to like great albums. And then we're going to wrap up by just sort of thinking through, you know, what we think the XPN countdown will have and, you know, album lists as a whole and all that sort of fun stuff. So any objections or should we get going?
Well, I guess I have an objection, and it's that we should outline, are we doing live albums here?
Well, I was going to quickly mention when I do my list and say that I did not include any live albums on my list. There's no reason why not. I know that there will be some on the XBN list. I've already seen people who have cast votes with Allman Brothers Live at Fillmore East is their number one album. I can't even say I disagree with that, but I just said I was doing studio albums only. I don't know if I don't think either of you guys voted for any live albums either, right?
Did not.
That's right. Yeah, I kept them off. I had a few in mind though.
And no compilations, no collections, no sort of odds and sods, any of that stuff?
I did no greatest hits albums, and all did original studio releases.
Okay. Okay, great. So we have some rules here. That's good. I'm saying that mostly because I know you're the guy, Chris, who might try to break the rules a little bit and just say that there's a Fish song that is the length of an entire album and that's able to get somehow. I don't know.
I assume you guys saw the big news this morning, right?
No.
Fish is releasing the entire Clifford Ball on vinyl. 12 records. I believe it's going to be like 7 hours and 15 minutes. I think the listing price is like $468. I got on to get my copy early. I assume you guys like were there ahead of me, right? Right?
No.
Charged at any price.
I wasn't at the Clifford Ball, actually. That was, I read about the Clifford Ball right after it happened in the summer of 96 and decided there was no way I was going to miss the next big Fish festival. So I was at the Great Went the following year, which as of yet not been released on vinyl, but fingers crossed next year.
And it'll go for $568 retail or something like
that's
that.
That's a bargain.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd pay just that for the gin, the bathtub gin from the second day.
It's the most expensive bathtub gin I've ever heard of in my life. All right, Chris, how do we start this? Who's starting our list here? We're going to do our individual list, right?
Yep. I think we'll go in alphabetical order, which means I get to go first.
Okay.
Or maybe just because I suggested I go first. But so here we go. I'm going to do these again. I'll start with my number 10, go to number one. And I'll just quickly say, like, my reaction to this was trying to do more favorite albums than, like, greatest albums. And I own all 10 of these I own on vinyl. And all 10 of these are ones that I go back to a lot. Like, I listen to these albums frequently. And I cut a couple at the last minute that were like, oh, these are, you know, this is a great album or this is, you know, terrific. But when I was being honest with myself, I don't go back and listen to it that often. So these are my 10 favorite albums of all time. So here we go. Number 10, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot by Wilco. Number 9, Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses. Number 8, Jailbreak by Thin Lizzy. Number 7, Wildflowers by Tom Petty. Number 6, the most recent album on my list from 2016, Worry by Jeff Rosenstock. Number 5, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You by Aretha Franklin. Number 4, Southeastern by Jason Isbell. Number 3, Otis Blue, Otis Redding Sings Soul by Otis Redding. Number 2, Abbey Road by a band we talked about a little bit here, the Beatles. And number 1, which I spoiled a few episodes ago, It's a Shame About Ray by the Lemonheads from 1992. And I'll just quickly end by saying number 1 was a really easy choice for me, and 2 through 4 were really easy choices for me. Maybe not the order, but those were like sort of no-brainers. If you ask me again in like 4 or 5 months, the rest of them could shuffle around, but I feel pretty good about that list. All ones that I go back to a ton.
All right. I guess we're not going to spend too much time talking about these, obviously, but I did want to ask you, who's the artist who I'd never heard of in there? Because there's one definitely.
Jeff Rosenstock.
So tell me a little bit about him.
Well, the reason why we're recording this on November 29th instead of November 30th is because I'm going to see Jeff Rosenstock in concert on November 30th, which is tomorrow night. He is from Brooklyn. He's, you know, a sort of a DIY guy. This was an album that came out in the summer of 2016. And I completely intended to listen to it because I read a review of it. And it sounded like it was right up my alley. And I didn't listen to it until Thanksgiving Day 2016 when I was living in London. And I put it on when I was on the train headed towards the city. And I think I listened to it 4 times that day and about 11 times over the weekend. And it just blew me away. I mean, it's like 30 some minutes long, 17 or 18 songs. Like nothing is long. It's like, I would describe it as punk adjacent. It's definitely not hardcore punk, but there are punk influences to it. But the album sort of is about various stages of relationships. And it sort of jumps around. There's also some commentary about the music industry involved in there. And, you know, he produced it himself. He recorded it himself. And I mean, he's had a couple albums since then that I think have even been, you know, like better reviewed. I don't know, like Post was the one that immediately followed this that was a really big critical darling and like a year or two later. But I don't know. This one just blew me away. Like I said, it's one I go back to all the time.
Very cool. I'll have to listen to it now. You've now given me a name. So there you go. I guess that means Ted is next with your top 10, because we're going alphabetical now.
There you go.
Exactly. Okay, great. Without further ado, number 10 on my list is Elephant by the White Stripes. Number 9, Is This It by the Strokes. Number 8, Let It Bleed by the Rolling Stones. Number 7, Separation Sunday by the Hold Steady. Number 6, The Southern Harmony and Musical Companion by the Black Crowes. Number 5, The Beatles by the Beatles, aka the White Album. Number 4, Physical Graffiti by Led Zeppelin. Number 3, Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd. Number 2, AM by the Arctic Monkeys. And number 1 on my list, OK Computer by Radiohead. And, you know, it's interesting in putting together the list. I kind of had the same thought that you did, Chris, as far as, first of all, it's so much fun to do this. And I think we music geeks, I mean, it's all about lists. And, well, obviously, we're talking on a podcast that's one big giant list. So that's a great thing. But, you know, it another thing that's kind of fun about this is I realize this list as it sits right now isn't hard-coded in my DNA. And if I do this again, like you said, in a month or a year, despite the fact that all these albums feel really important and I think will always be really important, I think it's interesting because those things shift a little bit, you know, for this reason or that reason. And so, you know, I kind of had that same thought. And I think, you know, when I look at my list, I think it's a mix of older stuff and then newer stuff. And, you know, a lot of older stuff, I mean, you know, a handful of these were before I was born, and I guess before any of us were born. But, you know, I think part of the reason that that's the case is you realize that a lot of these things are kind of like the building blocks for what I love about music. And, you know, certainly the White Album is that way. I think I was listening to that in the womb, in the crib, and then, you know, up until earlier today. But then, you know, it's fun to find some newer things that I actually remember seeing played live on those tours and things like that. So there we have.
I think, what's that? Jeremy Dillon does the My Favorite Album podcast, and he always says that the best album is definitely one that came out when you were 16. And that's sort of a weird paraphrase, but it's like, for me, it's definitely, I think it's not quite the necessarily even one that came out. It's like the one that hits you when you're that age is the one that stays with you. And, you know, I talked about that with the Lemonheads for me, and it's like, I get that. It's like there's these ones that are those building blocks, and it's harder sometimes for those newer albums to break in. And a couple quick hits on yours. I love the Arctic Monkeys. I think you can make an argument that AM's the second best album called AM, though, if you're a big Wilco fan. And I know you're in Chicago. So, you know.
Well, that's fair. Yeah, fair enough.
The only other thing I'll say is I'm with you on Is This It. As long as you're including the original cover only and not the sanitized version that came out, you know, post September 11th.
Yeah, well, this is a family show, as I understand it. So no disagreement there.
Is it my turn?
It is your turn.
Okay.
Let's go. Cool.
I'm the only other person left. All right. By the way, I did kind of like a personal, but also I was thinking about how people vote in this list. And I wanted to be a little more modern at times, a little bit more sort of things that people might not vote for typically with an XPN list. So I was just kind of keeping that in mind as I did this. So my number 10, Crazy Sexy Cool by TLC. Number 9, To Pimp a Butterfly by Kendrick Lamar. Number 8, I Am by Earth, Wind & Fire. Number 7, Meriwether Post Pavilion by Animal Collective. Number 6, Third Eye Blind by Third Eye Blind. Number 5, Graceland by Paul Simon. Number 4, Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. Number 3, Sign of the Times by Prince. Number 2, Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder. And number 1, Abbey Road by the Beatles. I think that's been on everybody's list or close to Abbey Road.
No, Ted had the White Album, but not Abbey Road.
So okay, okay, okay.
I was about ready to say, it's interesting. That's the Beatles are the only band to appear on
the thread. Yeah, yeah.
But that's definitely the common thread. It may pop up again later. Who knows? I was also at some point prepared to perhaps ill-advisedly make a joke about Third Eye Blind, but then I went back and listened to that album and it's terrific.
Oh, it's good.
But then I also realized that it's like, you know, the age difference between the two of us is, it's like I went with my number one is the Lemonheads and you've got Third Eye Blind. And it's like, there's a line when in Harry Met Sally, when they meet at the dinner scene and he says, Pesto is the quiche of the 80s. I mean, I think there is an article to be written that is Third Eye Blind is the Lemonheads of 1997, right? I mean, they're very similar albums when you think about it. And they're both, 14, 15 songs long. Not a lot of long songs. The Third Eye Blind one's definitely longer, but there probably is something I don't want to pry too deeply into your psyche. And I definitely don't want anybody to do that with me and the Lemonheads. But it's like there's something that just hits you at the age that it came out that album just sort of works. And it feels, it seems deeper maybe than what it is when you're that age when you're listening to it. But that, again, for the Lemonheads, for me, that just sort of lasted forever.
Yeah, I mean, what you said with, you know, your favorite album is the one that came out when you're about 16. Well, I think I first heard Third Eye Blind when I was about 13 or 14. So it's around that time and it stayed with me forever and it kept coming back to me in different ways in my life. So, and plus it's just a great, like the songs have so many hooks and they're crunchy songs and they're singable songs and they're fun. And even the album tracks are really stellar. So I'm all about it. I want more people to hear it. That's why I put it on the list. So there you go.
All right. Are we ready for the official Hall of Songs album list?
The official. We should have some sort of fanfare for this. How about a little fanfare?
Aaron Copland's fanfare for the common man, right?
I was going to say Todd Rundgren's How About a Little Fanfare.
Oh, that's also good.
Either one
is probably
great.
More appropriate. All right. Number 10 on the official Hall of Songs album list is Asia by Steely Dan. I'm shocked. This is the only Steely Dan on any of our lists. We're going to get voted out of the White Guy Club. In the corner of my eye, I saw you in Rudy's. You were very high. You were high. It was a crying disgrace. They saw your face on the counter by your keys. Was it?
I will never get voted out of the White Guy Club.
Yeah, I think that ship has sailed for all of us.
So Steely Dan, Asia. We haven't talked about Steely Dan on the actual podcast yet because they're not, you know, we're not there yet. Although we're about to get there with Steely Dan 1972. This is just, I think, the peak of everything that they're doing production-wise, storytelling-wise. Their whole vibe, their recording, all of this kind of comes together with this album. And then it's also both accessible and sort of abstract and artistic at the same time. We wanted to get something that was very smooth and very yachty on here because we both have yacht rock. We both come from a
yacht rock ties.
Yeah, yacht rock ties. So this was the album that kind of represents that for us. But I'm about to sing Black Cow if I keep going here. So I'll just stop now with that.
I was about ready to just whip out a guitar and do the solo from Peg. So Ted, what do you think about Steely Dan?
You know, I wouldn't say that Steely Dan is a blind spot for me, but I certainly know Steely Dan's kind of I think the things that you heard on the radio best. And it's interesting. I feel like in the last 5 years, for whatever reason, at least in terms of what I've been, you know, reading and listening to, there's been, I don't know that you'd call it a critical sort of reevaluation of Steely Dan. And obviously part of it may have to do with Walter Becker's death, but I feel like we're at a point right now where there's a tremendous amount of Steely Dan love out there. And, you know, obviously the production values that they put together are pretty, well, if not influential, you know, somewhat historic, and they're well known for that. I wouldn't say that they're one of my favorite bands, but it's definitely a band to whom I can listen pretty readily and that I respect a lot.
So I need to just expound a little bit on this Steely Dan Renaissance, because I feel as if Chris and I are kind of on the front of that in some ways. The whole Steely Dan Renaissance over the past several years, a couple factors, one being Walter Becker's death for sure. Another being, I think, white guys like us of this age or so who grew up with fathers who loved Steely Dan, kind of becoming Steely Dan fans as well in our middle age. I definitely can attest to that. My dad is a huge Steely Dan fan and introduced me to them. But also the Yacht Rock video series that came out 15 years ago plus that I got into early on. And I know, Chris, you got into, and the podcast Beyond Yacht Rock starting from that only in the last, 6 years, I think is when that started, 5 years ago. And they really brought back sort of an attention for Steely Dan that we both called to. And I think that's when we started talking, is really through Beyond Yacht Rock and our love of Yacht Rock. Those are the ties we have. So I think those things, those three things sort of are the main factors that make Steely Dan sort of back in the limelight again for at least middle-aged white men like ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I certainly did not grow up having my dad play Steely Dan. He was much more likely to be listening to Conway Twitty or Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. But I think that there's that. I think that definitely that's, I got back into Steely Dan large part because of Beyond Yacht Rock, which I think came out around 2015. It was right around when I moved to London. And because I got into it, I was a little bit late in that, but it's like, there's something else to it though, that I think has given it a hook to stay. And I think, like, to Ted's point about the great production values, I think there's a really high value put on some of that. There's, you know, I guess even like thinking like their sort of their legacy carrying on through bands like Daft Punk, and where there sort of is this sort of like really, really well-produced, well-crafted song, that some of that owes its roots to Steely Dan. And I think that part of what Beyond Yacht Rock was doing was they were sort of, I mean, very frequently joking around about many things, but also going back to that precision and the fact that how like sort of clever some of this music was. And I do think there is, at least in the right circle, still some, you know, credit given to cleverness and things like that.
Let's move on to the number 9 selection in our top 10 albums list for Hall of Songs. And that is Currents by Tame Impala.
Speaking of, you know, these crafted studio productions, I mean, can you get any more so than the great Kevin Parker?
Yeah, there's even sort of a dash of Yacht Rock in some of this album. I mean, he was definitely listening to late 70s and early 80s pop rock as part of the inspiration for this album, which is a menagerie of sounds and sonics and combining psychedelia and rock and pop together to make this really indelible piece of music that is both a head trip, and also you can listen to each song by themselves and dance to them rhythmically, and I'll just enjoy them on their own.
One of the things that I think is so great about Currents is that, you know, in prior to that, Tame Impala, which of course is essentially a one-man band, you know, we thought about what a guitar virtuoso Kevin Parker is. And, you know, when he seemed kind of like, all right, well, he's a, you know, a Jimmy Page accolade or something like that. But then with Currents, you're right. There's danceable stuff on it. There's synths on it. There's a great variety of things. And so I think that is kind of a great package of all the things that they can do.
Fascinating that that we talk about them is like, it really is a Kevin Parker production. The guy who plays guitar for him was, what is it? I think his name is Dominic something, who played guitar on some of their earlier stuff. And I think even like on Elephant, going back to their, to some of their earlier stuff, I actually saw him open for the Arctic Monkeys. And it was like a completely different style than, you know, Kevin Parker and all of that. And I don't know, there's something about sort of Kevin Parker's studio genius that is, that is like, you know, to Tim's point, that it's really sort of timeless, that it throws back to the 70s, but it's also kind of ahead of its time.
Yeah, he's a thread that I have in my life of listening to music is I love the one man bands and production people like Paul McCartney, Stevie Wonder, Todd Rundgren. Those kinds of artists I gravitate toward quite a bit. And Kevin Parker's just part of that long line. And also there's a personal thing with that album with me. So it's always been at the top of my list. I'm glad that you appreciate it too, Chris, at that level. So happy to have it on the list. Why don't we get to number 8?
All right. Before we do, we should actually, Ted asked us to do this. We didn't do it. We didn't sort of like describe how we came to our list. We can take a break here between number 9 and 8 and say quickly, like we sort of like, went back and forth. And I think what we were trying to do is not be like uber controversial, right? We weren't trying to dig up some sort of relic from the past that nobody had ever heard of and say, okay, this is one of the 10 albums. We were trying to sort of take into like what we're sort of doing with this project here and capture, you know, the greatest songs of all time and sort of carry that over into these like legacy albums. And again, I don't want to speak for you, but I think it was this idea of like, let's try to capture a wide range of eras, a wide range of styles, without going like, you know, crazy deep and like not sort of, you know, pulling some sort of, you know, Cascade Foxed Scandinavian, not even real band to include on our list.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I couldn't have said it better myself. So why don't you just, that leads really great into our number 8. Why don't you just tell us what it is?
Yeah, that's what made me think about it. Because number 8 on our list is 1989 by Taylor Swift. You got that jeans.
This is great. I mean, I think this is her best album. It sort of combines all the things that she was trying to do in her career into a great package, and it's expertly produced and a lot of well-written songs here. And obviously it's been sort of covered ad nauseum to this point, but it's really great.
And in the sort of in the Hall of Songs criteria that is typically applied, obviously influence is a big piece of it. And, you know, this is not an album that's 30 years old, but this has already been so huge, you know, both you're right in terms of literal covers, but then also the influence that this has had on so many other artists in the industry. So I think that's a great choice, guys.
I just love the pop songs on here. I mean, it really is wild. Like every time I listen to this one, I kind of have a different favorite song and I'm listening to it. I'm like, oh yeah, this is the best one on here. And then you go back and you listen to it again. There's a different one. I mean, she writes some just killer, killer songs. It is like loaded with hooks from start to finish. And I don't know. I mean, there's like, this is one of those two that it's like, there's not really a note that's wrong on it. And I don't know. It's like, that's, like I said, somebody were asking me what my favorite song on this album is. I'd give you one and then tomorrow would be a different one. And that's what I think is a sign of a great album of this vein. That's really just trying to be, you know, song after song. That's killer.
Yeah. What I love about this album is how each song has its own very unique sonic vibe to it. And how, if you even just read the title of the song, you know what you're in for and it actually delivers on that. Like I think of Style and how sleek and polished and 80s almost that sounds, but it's still very modern and sexy and fun. Out of the Woods is just a tremendous sort of steamroller of a pop song. Wildest Dreams is great. I mean, I've only gotten into that really hardcore recently. And I mean, like you said, Chris, there are songs on this album that you come back to and you're like, oh, this is now my favorite song from this album. And that's just going to keep going, I think, because there is such a staying power here.
Well, and the good news is, of course, we'll get another version of this album at some point. She's re-recording all of her albums so that she owns the masters and stuff. So who knows what she'll do to, you know, change it up a little bit for round two.
It may even be as long as the Fish's new version of the Clifford Ball. Like, we'll get like a 6-hour version of 1989.
The 12-minute Winter Twee Bad Blood remix. Okay. Our number 7 entry on our Hall of Songs Greatest Albums list, number 7 on the list, is Rhythm Nation 1814 by Janet Jackson. Talk about hits. So many hits on this album. This is such a tremendous hit machine of an album, but it also is the sound of an entirely new genre of music just coming alive here.
Yeah, I mean, this is one for me that I think I was 12 when this album came out, and I was definitely in the, you know, high time of listening to like Top 40 radio and watching MTV. And it was one where like hit after hit after hit kept coming out, and you just couldn't believe it that there could be that many singles from the same album. And then you go back and listen to it now, and you're like, I mean, yeah, they're all that good. And then some of the album tracks are still great too. And to me, it is one of the early albums that has those sort of like interludes and sort of, you know, things in between the songs. I mean, you've got like rock operas like Tommy, which obviously had some of that, but this is one of the first of the sort of the new generation of these albums that were sort of doing different things and setting up the songs in between, which was just so cool. So it's like it was packed with these singles that were huge hits, but then it also, as an album, still holds up so well.
Yeah, 8 singles, 7 in the top 10, I believe, and 4 number one hits. I mean, like, you couldn't escape this album for about a year and a half to 2 years. And like with 1989, every time I listen to it, a different song pops out to me. I think most recently I've been really into Black Cat because it's when Janet goes really hard rock. You know, like, you don't get that in an R&B album in the 80s until this point. And that's maybe Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, the producers behind it, you know, really letting her expand her sound here.
There's a recent, I know Chris is familiar with Sound Opinions, the podcast that's, you know, distributed all over the place with NPR. They recently did a great interview with Jimmy Jam, and he talks a lot about working with Janet on this album. Worth a listen. The thing that I think of, I think Chris and I are right about the same age. This was a huge MTV album, which obviously for those of us of a certain age, was a huge part of the music industry, a huge part of what, you know, created that sort of musical DNA that we all have. And there were so many solid videos because the songs were so good from Rhythm Nation.
Yeah, that's a great point about the videos. And it's like, we've talked, going back to like our early episodes about like 1951 and like the early 50s, about how music gets distributed. And I hadn't really thought about the fact that like things are going to change. I mean, we're still several episodes away, but when you get into the 80s, because you can't separate some of these songs from their videos. And, you know, now there, it's like, that's less so. There's everything sort of, you know, comes and goes, but there's definitely going to be an era where there are songs that we're going to be considering, do they make the list or not? And you're not going to be able to say, does the song, like, you can't separate it from the video, I guess, because they are sort of intertwined. And this is definitely of that era.
Speaking of which, Chris, the next one, I think it attests to that pretty well.
Yes, this is one where I've definitely remember a few videos. Number 6 is Weezer by Weezer, commonly known as the Blue Album.
Yeah, you got Buddy Holly, you got Say It Ain't So, you have the Sweater Song, indelible videos, but also incredible pop rock songs, just perfect 3.5 minute little symphonies.
Yeah, this was a really tough cut from my own personal top 10 list. Again, this is one that I still go back to all the time whenever I can't. If I can't think what else to listen to, this is one I just throw on because I know I'm going to be happy for the next 40 minutes or whatever it is. Just, you know, fun from start to finish. Silly, silly lyrics, but they work. And again, like what she said, like I can still, when it gets to Buddy Holly, I picture this silly video in my head as well.
Yeah, this is such a strong album from start to finish. And you start to get, you don't have quite a sense for what a strange dude Rivers Cuomo sort of is. He seems very typical rock star through a lot of it, but you get some glimpses, I think partly from the videos, but yeah, this one, this is something I still listen to quite regularly. Definitely stands up
to me. There's a sort of a Brian Wilson quality to Rivers in this album, especially a song like In the Garage, where he's singing about the Kiss posters and sort of just being alone and how no one can touch me kind of a thing. And then of course The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, which to me is like an update of I just wasn't made for these times, you know, that kind of a thing. It's like, he's got a certain way of sort of crafting these lyrics that are, you know, very like teenage friendly and kind of pull at your heartstrings a little bit, but are still accessible to the older audience. And of course, as you say, you know, we'll get later on in the Weezer, you know, career, and we'll hear stranger and stranger stuff and sort of lyrics that don't make as much sense at all. But this is definitely a moment in time that I'm glad that, you know, I had what, age 8 or 9, but I really sort of got into as a teenager.
Yeah. Steven Hayden talks a lot about the Killers as being a band who are like a great singles band and could not put together an album, you know, where it's like things and I'm not asking to, you know, agree or disagree with that, but my reaction to Weezer a lot is that they kind of became that band, but that this was their one sort of effort where they poured everything into one album that just really does work from start to finish. And then after that, like for me at least, in their later stuff, I'll be able to pull a song or two from almost every album and be like, that's fun, I'm going to listen to that one over and over again. But this is the only one to me where it really does work from start to finish. And I know some people, like Pinkerton became a cult favorite later, but this is the one to me that works and does exactly what they were trying to do.
I think Pinkerton's a great album all the way through, but I will vouch for Sam's Town by the Killers. I'm sorry. I still have a soft spot for that one.
I was going to bring that up later, but.
Okay, I'm going to stop right there. Yes, this is Tim from Hall of Songs. I sound a little different than I just did earlier, but that's because I'm recording this portion after the actual conversation that we had. It's in a different room. It's a little different production values. I'm sorry about that. Nevertheless, this is the halfway point of the episode, or at least of this countdown, so I wanted to kind of insert myself here and say, hey, if this is your first time listening to our podcast, thank you. We really appreciate it. We'd love for you to listen to other episodes. We can be found anywhere you find podcasts, whether it is Amazon or Google or Spotify. We are, of course, on Apple Podcasts, and we'd love for you to go there and listen to us there, subscribe to us there, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. Please just say something about us if you can, or at least just give us a rating. Please do that, because the more that we get ratings, the better we look in the eyes of other people, and we can get more listeners, and I would just love for that to happen, because we'd like to keep this going and continue this entire podcast. It's a labor of love, so we love doing it, and we'd love to keep going. If you can, listen to our back catalog. We started this podcast back in February, and we started with the year 1951. The whole idea is to go year by year to figure out the greatest songs of all time, put them in a hall of fame of sorts. So go to our website, hallofsongs.com, and check out our back catalog, starting in 1951, going all the way up until 1971, which is our latest episode. Go check out our bonus episodes as well. We talk to some other folks. We talk about the Beatles. We talk about the Grateful Dead. Some other things that we both like, or one of us likes, or whatever. It's all out there at hallofsongs.com and on all of the platforms where you find podcasts. Again, check us out at Amazon, Spotify, Google, of course, Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends, tell everybody that you know who loves music about our podcasts. We've talked about a lot of great songs and a lot of great artists, and we've given histories of all these artists and these songs and really gave great opinions on them, I think at least. Maybe we didn't. you can be the judge. Nevertheless, we'd love to get feedback. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear from more people. So listen at hallofsongs.com. Email us at hallofsongspod@gmail.com. And I hope you keep listening because this has been so much fun. And without further ado, I should just stop now. And let's get back to the real recording. Next up, the next song. Bye. All right. Our number 5 of our top 10 albums, Tapestry by Carole King.
So obviously Tapestry, I mean, I can't remember the exact distinction it has, but for a while, I think it was the biggest selling album ever. Recently, I unearthed a bunch of old vinyl of my dad's, and Tapestry was one of the albums in it. And, you know, over the years, obviously, in reading lists like this, you always hear about it, and Carole King is rightly very famous for everything that she's done, you know, twice a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But because I found those albums again, I had occasion to listen to it, and I just forgot how much from start to finish is on that album and how consistently strong it is. The band that plays on it, and as I had the benefit, of course, of looking at the original vinyl, and there's pictures of a lot of the musicians there. The backing musicians that she had helping her out with that is pretty substantial, too. But yeah, that's certainly a classic album.
Yeah, we just did our 1971 episode, and of course, Tapestry is 1971. We did not include any Carole King Tapestry songs in our nominee list for that year. And I think ultimately my argument was there's so many good songs. I don't know if there's one song that really rises above all the others as this elite level, like we have to talk about this song kind of a thing. Whereas there are really just like 7 or 8 really great songs in this album that kind of are, like you said, consistent. This is a consistently great listen all the way through. And so I think you have to take this more in as an album, even though all the singles can stand apart on their own. And you're right. Like there are times I look at this album and I forget that, oh, wow, I didn't know that, you know, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, her cover of that is on here, or, you know, that Beautiful is on here, which, you know, became, you know, kind of a modern, you know, had its renaissance with the musical. So it is just, it's a wonderful, wonderful piece of music.
Yeah, this was probably number 12 on my top 10 list, and, you know, just barely missing the cut. And like I said on our episode, this is my favorite album of 1971. I think it's probably the best album of 1971, even though there's things like, you know, What's Going On, and just absolutely incredible albums from 1971. And it was such a struggle to leave these songs off of that list. But I think I agree with that completely. It's like, it's like if some of the other songs were worse, it would have been easier to pull a couple songs off of it to throw them on the list and say, okay, here's the, you know, quote unquote single from Tapestry that gets there. But it's just great. I mean, the whole story of it is just, is incredible as well. And I mean, it's like, this is one, I have it on vinyl. I think I have one of my, you know, parents' old worn copies of Tapestry as well. And this is another one that I listened to it, you know, so frequently that it's sort of, you know, it's like when one song ends, I instantly start to sing the next song in my head because I know what's going to come into it just because it's so, you know, sort of intertwined. And, you know, like just great, great album. And, you know, we talked about how great of a year in music 1971 was, whether you want to, you know, regardless of how much you want to glorify it, but there's no denying it. There was so much good stuff that came out, and I would stand by this being the best album that came out in that terrific year.
So 1971 is a great year. I think you would have to have another contender for greatest year in music history in 1987. So many great albums from this year that came out. And Chris, you have the honor of giving one from 87 as our next entry.
Yeah, I get to introduce one for the second time. One that was also on my top 10 list. Here we go. Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses. Yeah. A little different than Tapestry.
A lot more cowbell and whistles.
Yeah. And also, a Tapestry has an A side and a B side, whereas, you know, as opposed to the G side and the R side, right?
Nicely done. So this is, I mean, this is one of, is this your favorite album of all time, or this is close to your favorite album of all time, right?
I mean, well, I this was on my list is really high. I just, yeah. I mean, I'd like, there's not, there, I don't know. This is one that I will admit, I probably would have had it even closer to number one if it wasn't for sort of rethinking some of the social mores that are set forth in the album, if you will. I think that it's one where you can listen to it now and excuse some of it for, you know, Axl basically being a character and writing about what he was seeing and doing at the time. I don't think that makes necessarily all of it forgivable, but I think I might, but it's still like it, the music is so incredible. The sounds that they glue together are so incredible. This sort of like late 70s, early 80s punk sound combined with like hair metal, combined with this like classic rock sound, and then even like they their use of the acoustic guitar when they need it, and just like the passion that is poured into every song is just really, really like just amazing to me. And it's one of those where I first heard it, it was like, you know, pure guilty pleasure that I was probably listening to it and my parents didn't think I should have been. And now I listen to it, my parents probably still don't think I should be listening to it, but it really, really does hold up well. And it still sounds terrific, even if some of the lyrics might not hold up quite as well.
I mean, it almost feels like a greatest hits album. I mean, if from my personal view, you could almost just throw November Rain on it, and that would pretty much cover most of what I need from GNR. But it's, I mean, it's, you know, no pun intended, I suppose, but it's like a night train running you over. I mean, that's an album that just kind of grabs you from the start. Obviously, you know, Welcome to the Jungle is quite a way to begin. And just sort of the whole thing, you know, it really kind of doesn't give up. It doesn't stop. And you're right. Sometimes it's better to appreciate the music than the actual words coming out of Axl's mouth, which may actually be a good advice for life as a general matter. But I mean, wow. What an album. And I do remember being somewhat, so I would have been 10. I remember the Welcome to the Jungle video being kind of scared of it in a certain way. Maybe for some good reasons. But yeah, it's just to this day remains a fantastic album.
Yeah, the album tracks on this are even just tremendous. Out to Get Me and Think About You. And I mean, like
My Michelle.
Yeah, My Michelle's great. I mean, like the hits themselves are, I mean, when we get to 1987, I'm sure we'll probably have at least one song from this album in our nominee list. I'm not probably spoiling anything there, but I mean, this has the combination of enduring classic once in a lifetime kind of songs, but also album tracks that just put you in this entirely, you know, unique place. This band has done things that nobody had ever done up until this point. So it's a tremendous album, and I'm not the biggest GNR fan, but I can completely appreciate, you know, every second of this one.
Is there a better first track of a debut album than Welcome to the Jungle?
Welcome, I mean, that is Welcome definitely to the, like, Working Week.
Also good.
I would put in a pitch for Break On Through as a solid start to the Doors catalog, but I have my biases there.
I would go, I always like Good Times, Bad Times as well, which I think is a great, you know, introduction to Zeppelin. But
But in terms of 1987, I wish you guys all the best of luck in figuring out whether it's going to be Welcome to the Jungle, Paradise City, or Sweet Child of Mine, if you're only going to pick one. I mean, maybe it's a Who's Next kind of situation, but I mean, just those three alone, wow.
I have a bias on that one, but I'll save that for 1987.
I'm excited for our email conversations for that one.
Yeah, and I won't push it too hard either, because it's like I said, it is definitely a personal thing, not necessarily the one that's the best, but it'll be fun to talk. I mean, there's so many great, like, I mean, you know, on my album list, way high, and now here at number four on ours. So moving on.
Yeah, our number three album is one of my top albums. It is Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder. And baby, that's you.
you made life his story. Cause you brought some joy inside my tears. You have done what no one thought could be.
So this is, I mean, Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life has been written about, talked about ad nauseum. It is a compendium of sounds and influences and flavors and everything that Stevie could potentially dream up and put on an album in 1976. It is a triple album, or two and a half albums, I guess, whatever it is. It's two LPs and an EP. It is... I mean, every song is like 8 minutes long, and yet they're also great pop songs by themselves. You have huge hits, you have incredible album tracks, you have just journeys, sonic journeys, you have really weird moments like children's blurting out names of famous Black people, and you have just really cool instrumentals that just go 55 miles an hour or whatever it is. I mean, it is just everything Stevie can do wrapped up in a package, and I could. This could be the only album I ever listened to in my life, and I'll be fine with that.
Well, there's just so much to it. I mean, I guess not unlike the White Album or Physical Graffiti. Clearly, I have a preference for big pieces of music. there's just so much to it. Obviously, there's quantity, but like you mentioned, there's so much variety. And then, you know, you've got stuff like Sir Duke, that you can listen to over and over, and you'll hear on the radio all the time. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it feels kind of like the magnum opus for what is a fantastic career, and frankly, a guy who put together multiple fantastic albums right in a row in a way that's pretty unusual.
Yeah, I know Jack Hamilton, who used to write for Slate, had a thing on the, you know, sort of best however many in a row albums runs that you want to say. And I think, right, if you could say that between 72 and 76, that it went Talking Book, Inner Visions, and Songs in the Key of Life. I mean, I know there was what Fulfillingness first finale was in the middle there, but like it is, you've got this just amazing amount of music that is packed into these few years by Stevie Wonder. And then like, to your point, there's so much amazing music packed into this one album. I mean, it's great. This is one that I love this one. My kids were lucky enough to go see Stevie Wonder play at City Hall in Philadelphia when he did this like pop-up free concert, and their nanny who was there like ran them up because she heard they were playing and went to go see him, and he played like several songs from this, and I was trapped in the office and didn't get to get there, but so jealous of them getting to see that. And this is one that like it's definitely like they still remember that, and but it's like, you know, you look through the track list of this and it's, you know, I mean, like what Ted said, like comparing it to the White Album or something like that, there's just so much there. There's so many things that you forget about. And then when you go back and listen to those things that you've forgotten about, they're also so good.
Yeah, there's a song for every occasion, right? You have your Sir Duke, which is your party song. Love's in Need of Love Today. It's a very important song over the past couple of years where we're all just trying to look for something to hold on to. Village Ghetto Land, which is this great scathing, you know, look at society in the 1970s. If It's Magic is a song that I listened to sort of as a young father and just kind of tearing up, like hearing about the way that Stevie's trying to, you know, this is where we can go as a society. And then there's Saturn, where he's dreaming of an entirely different society altogether, a different planet altogether where everything's okay. I mean, there is just an incredible wealth of viewpoints and songs and ideas here. It's again, everything you need.
All right. Number two on our list. This was number 11 on my list, the hardest cut. Fear of a Black Planet by Public Enemy. Snake bitten, bitch bitten the face. But the rhymes keep fitting, respect's been given. How's your living? Now I can't protect a paid off defect. Check the record and record, inattentional wreck. Raid off as some intellect. Made the call, took the fall, broke the laws. Not my fault that they're falling off. Known as fair and square throughout my years. Saw the growl at the living cow. Black to the bone, my home is your home. But welcome to the Terror Dome.
This would have been pretty high up on my list too. This is just an assault of amazing drum, rhythm, funk on top of or on top of that is Chuck D, like some of the best lyrics you can find in hip hop, especially in 1990. What an album.
Yeah, I put this one on like 2 weeks ago while I was walking someplace. And that intro, it's like, if it came out today, it would still be kind of terrifying and blow you away. And just to, you know, sort of put yourself back, you know, 20 some years when this came out. I mean, this is just a mind-blowing album and one that's still, you know, again, like we've said this in relation to, I guess, what's going on. Unfortunately, still relevant today for many of the messages that, you know, that they're getting across, but just a really, really brilliantly produced album. And I love every song on this one.
And just so incredibly influential. I mean, you think about, you could create a big family tree of everybody that not only Public Enemy, but even just this album, you know, both within the hip hop world and I think beyond that, you know, who have been tremendously influenced by this. So yeah, great pick.
Yeah, just how smart this is too. You know, the little, I mean, you talked about with Rhythm Nation, the interludes. This is another album that kind of uses that interlude sort of that structure where after every song or every two songs, you get, you know, maybe 20 seconds of just an instrumental or media snippets. I mean, it's Incident at 66.6 FM, where there's that entire sort of, here's what everybody in the media is saying about Public Enemy. And, you know, talking about sort of just the racism that is coded in everything that people are saying about them, leading into Welcome to the Terror Dome, which I think is the best track on the album. It is just a powerful, powerful jam. And Chuck D is never better than in that one. It's just so intelligent, this album, all the way through. And as you said, prescient and also very relatable in this day and age.
Yeah. And then it ends with like War at 33 and a Third, where it's like it's a commentary on rap music itself, where he is, you know, intentionally sort of speaking at a speed that, you know, he otherwise could not do, while, you know, explicitly referencing the Black Panthers, and then finally wraps up, at least on the final album versions, with Fight the Power. I mean, it's like it's one of those that it starts out like it just blasts you in the face out of the gate. And then at the end, you're still like, oh, yeah, I mean, it doesn't stop. I mean, just absolutely brilliant from start to finish.
That leads us to our number one selection, our pick for the Hall of Songs, the greatest album of all time. Ted, before we reveal that, do you have any guesses?
Well, I mean, there's one would have to assume based on what we've already heard that it would be Abbey Road. but perhaps you guys decided to throw a little bit of a little more variety in there. So maybe that's not the guess. But beyond that, I'm excited to learn.
Close. It is Deface the Music by Utopia. No, it is Abbey Road by the Beatles.
Look at that.
I mean, what haven't we said about Abbey Road at this point, right?
All right.
That's it, right?
There we go. We're done.
I mean, nevertheless, I mean, it's not the wrong answer. I mean, I think there's a lot of right answers, to be sure, but it's hard to argue with it, you know, based on all sort of the metrics. You know, it was good then. It's been incredibly influential. It stands up if you listen to it now. I know that at least Chris, I think probably you guys both watched the Get Back thing that's streaming right now. Fun to see some of these songs that ended up on Abbey Road sort of end up in their infancy as they were working through things there in Twickenham. And, you know, it certainly stands up. I'm sure Chris has done the pose walking across literal Abbey Road while he was a London resident.
It's interesting to me because if I would have done this, I think 10 years ago, I probably would have voted for the White Album. And then if I would have done it 5 years ago, I would have voted for Rubber Soul. And now Abbey Road is my Beatles album. But you could kind of like I don't even know why that is. You could sort of, you know, pick them out. You could, you know, swap them here and there. Like now I'm sort of at the point where Abbey Road, I think, was like their sort of quintessential like Beatles achievement. But there's no, I don't know. To me, if, for what we're doing here, the Beatles had to be number one. And I think Abbey Road probably had to be number one as well. But I don't know. Like as Ted said, there's a lot of right answers here.
I do think one of the things about Abbey Road is it does feel very modern in a way that even stuff on certainly Sgt. Pepper doesn't feel quite as modern. You know, you think about something like Come Together or I Want You. Those songs both have a certain heaviness to them that, you know, I think we heard more of, you know, from the Stones or kind of as you moved into the 70s that you didn't hear quite as much. There's some stuff on the White Album that's certainly comparable in that regard, but you know, maybe that's one of the reasons that it feels like will continue to live on. What's your take, Tim?
Yeah, I mentioned this in the 69 episode that it is so expertly produced and engineered. It sounds fantastic. They clearly were going for the biggest and most lush sound that they could do, and the way that they recorded it, you could hear, you know, like the there was this wonderful sort of sound wave throughout the album where, you know, the both of the edges aren't very sharp, they're just very soft, and then the middle is very, you know, big and huge. And so you hear it on a song like Here Comes the Sun. You mentioned I Want You. That's one that it's weird, like this album has been my favorite maybe for the past 15 years, and yet it still grows on me. I Want You is a song that I never really considered too highly before, but only in the last year I've really gotten into it in a way that like I'm not a huge like heavy rock guy, but that song sort of speaks to me now. And then of course the second side, you know, that entire second side medley that we talked about in our Veterans Committee episode. I mean, man, like that is as good a 20 minutes of music that you could find anywhere in all of music. I mean, that's it right there. So it's hard to say anything bad about it. And that's why it's our number one. I mean, it's just as perfect as it gets, in my opinion. So do you think that Abbey Road by the Beatles will be the number one album in the new 2021 XPN Greatest Albums of All Time countdown?
I do not. It was number one the last time they did this. I think that the number one album will be somebody that we have not talked about on any of our four lists, and that's going to be Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run.
Huh. Well, his Thunder Road was number one on the 2020 Greatest Songs of All Time list, which I immediately went, oh my God. I like Bruce Springsteen, and I like Thunder Road, and I like Born to Run. I like all that stuff. But yeah, I think it's a testament to maybe the audience that XPN has that maybe Bruce Springsteen will emerge victorious in this one.
Yeah, the fact that it's, I think Philly is a very Bruce friendly voting environment. So, and obviously, you know, I voted on this. I don't live in Philly. But my guess would be, and you guys can probably speak to this more as current and fellow or current and former Philly residents, but it's probably predominantly voting coming in from the XPN local listenership.
Yeah, I think it's probably largely Philly area. And I think that Springsteen does get a boost because of that. You know, he's probably the biggest name. Well, I mean, I think probably the biggest name we didn't have on any of our lists is Bob Dylan. Right. I mean, it's like, yeah. I never know what to do with Dylan because like Blonde on Blonde is my favorite album by Bob Dylan. But I don't know. It's like I sort of bounce back and forth with him a little bit. And in no way is that in any way a slight to him. But it's like I kind of feel like for him, I have albums that are either more seasonal or more, you know, that I sort of go through a phase where I want to listen to that. And I don't have the one that I necessarily always want to go back and listen to from start to finish.
I think with Dylan, this is just me, I find him to be somewhat repetitive at times where there's only so much of Bob's voice and Bob's general style that I can listen to at one time. So that might be, I mean, I'm with you that I don't listen to a Blonde on Blonde that often, even though it is my favorite of his too. And I do like a lot of his albums and I'm a Bob Dylan fan, but I think there's a certain moment where I just can't listen to him too much. And I had the same thing with Bruce. I like, there is only so much Bruce that I can listen to before I'm done listening to him. And I don't have that problem with the Beatles. I don't have that problem with many artists. I mean, the Stones, even Zeppelin, I don't have that problem with them. That's just my take, but I could see Dylan charting in the top 5 to 10 with at least one album.
You inadvertently, I inadvertently set you up to steal my joke earlier. I was going to say that the Springsteen album that really should be in the top 10 is Sam's Town by the Killers.
I mean, it is. It's very much a Springsteen album. That is very true. And it does have the same sort of, there are moments in Sam's Town where the lyrics are like, it's like, you know, the queen of the supermarket where you're like, okay, what are we doing here? But you're right.
Although Ted also had a Springsteen album on his list in that he had the Hold Steady with Separation Sunday. Yeah. I mean, like, these are like, that's the one thing about Springsteen that I am still processing is all these bands that I listen to today who are so influenced by Springsteen. And, you know, again, it's like his influence definitely lasts in ways that I don't think I processed until sometime the last couple of years about these, you know, it's like, it's stereotypical guitar rock in some ways, but there also is this, I don't know how to put it, there's sort of a regionality to it where people are singing about the place that they're from and singing about getting out of the place that they're from that Springsteen really did well. And that does carry on to a lot of these, you know, to these guitar bands that are still going today. And I joked about it, I guess. I think on one of our albums when I talked about Sam Fender, who's from Newcastle, that like Sam Fender is now making Bruce Springsteen albums. And he's, you know, a 21-year-old kid from Newcastle on Tyne in Northern England.
So I'm looking at you sent us the last XPN list and the top 40 or so. And this is 2005. The albums that are post, let's say 1985 on this list, there aren't many of them, but you have the Joshua Tree, you have Graceland is on here. The top 90s album is OK Computer, which Ted, you said was not your number one album. We have Counting Crows, August and Everything After on there. We have Jeff Buckley's Grace, Nirvana's Nevermind. How many albums from the past, let's say 30 years, if we go back to 1990, 91, are we going to see in this one? Do we think we're going to see many more albums post 1990, or do we think it's still going to be pretty heavy on the late 60s, early 70s?
You know, my guess would be that we would see more albums of that later period because, so this was from 2005. I feel like what you listen to in, you know, your preferred sort of medium right now, whether that's, you know, streaming the radio or listening to the radio, or even what you see on Saturday Night Live, it's not as much dudes with guitars, you know, that we're listening to all the time, and which I think is a good thing. But clearly there are a lot of different bands that are really influential on the people that we're listening to right now. And so I would have to guess that, and maybe it's because right now you really enjoy Lizzo in 2019. And so you start to unpack that and say, okay, I like her. Where did she, you know, get her influences? And then you start to discover things like, well, you know, all the many things that, you know, that one can hear in Lizzo. So based on that, I personally would guess that we would see more different things just because how they have fostered what we're listening to and seeing in 2021.
Yeah. Although I think about the songs list and there's these sort of weird, jumps, I think in the time frame where I think there's going to be these really, really contemporary albums that probably get a lot of love, like Lizzo, I think, well, I think Phoebe Bridgers will. I'm trying to think of some of the other XPN favorites recently that will probably be very high. And then I think there's going to be a dead zone that will probably go back from, like, you know, 2015 to 2000, but might stretch into the 90s a little bit, where they're not quite old enough to be considered classics, but they're not as fresh in your mind. And again, I think I talked about this on one of the ones where we're talking about the songs, where there were like several Dawes songs in the top 100 when XPN did its list in 2015. And then when they did the 2020 greatest songs, so almost three times as many songs, only one of those was still on the list a couple years later. Because, you know, the songs are in people's heads and, you know, they sort of stick with people and they're going to vote for it. So I would expect to see Phoebe Bridgers, Strange on the Alps, pretty high on this list. Lizzo, I think, will be high. I would think there's going to be some Adele lists that are going to be pretty high on this list, and some things that probably from the last 5-10 years. And some of those, if they do this again 5-10 years from now, will be way up there. Some of them, maybe not so much. And as opposed to things like Abbey Road, which, you know, I don't know where it's going to be. I would be willing to, you know, bet a small sum of money that it's going to be in the top 10. And if they do this 10 years from now, it's still going to be in the top 10.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm thinking of the 2000 to 2015 group now, and I'm thinking, well, that, you know, Kid A probably shows up there. Thinking like maybe there's an Outkast album that shows up there. I don't know if Stankonia is that album or if it's Speaker Box or something like that. And then I'm thinking like My Morning Jacket Z, you know, if you think of XPN artists, you know, those who they play, who did have some releases back then, you know, in the 2000s, the White Stripes, I'm sure will have, the Black Keys will have something. Yeah. So they'll be that kind of vibe, but you're right. I think it'll be a little bit fewer and farther between with that era.
We also haven't accounted for the prog rock mafia of Philadelphia. So the Yes album could very possibly be number one.
Close to the edge will be top 50. Fragile will be top 25. And there'll be King Crimson. There'll be Genesis, plenty of Genesis, I'm sure, but not Invisible Touch, which is their best album.
Yeah. Well, what about, speaking of a different Invisible Touch, what about 80s bands? I mean, that's the thing is like, we sort of talked about like, Appetite's 87, but like there's some great 80s and early 80s music, you know, like Roxy Music,
R.E.M.
I don't know. R.E.M. I mean, that's a great show. Yeah. Like, I don't know where these are going to come in. I mean, is it like, I think those are albums that are starting to get a lot of play on classic rock, and maybe they're going to start to pick up, some votes from people who are a little bit younger, who are starting to discover those. I just don't know. I don't know what to think about some of those. And I don't know what to think about like all those 80, like an album like Thriller, like where's Thriller going to be?
I don't think Thriller will be that, because we saw with the song list that, what was there, one or two Michael Jackson songs total on that list? And it's just a different audience, and maybe people have been a little bit, you know, turned off by the whole Michael Jackson personal life thing, and so they don't want to necessarily vote for him. But Thriller is an album that's continuously been considered one of the greatest, you know, 15, 25 albums of all time in a lot of lists, and so it would be surprising to see it off the list completely, but I don't think it'll be that high. I guess I have a question. If we're going to take bets, you said REM. What will be the highest charting REM album? Will it be Automatic? Will it be Green? Will it be Out of Time? What are we thinking?
Oh, it's a really good question. I guess it depends on if it's the folks. So who's going to champion REM? And is it going to be those of us that, met them through the sort of MTV period, or, you know, Automatic for the people when they became a big giant, it's funny. I mean, we forget about REM, I feel like, in what you read and listen to these days, but there was a period there where they were the biggest rock band in the world for a minute. Yeah. But you know, then a lot of folks look back to their earlier, you know, what you think is more kind of the college radio darling period of their lives before they were quite so big, but when they put together a lot of those really classic early albums. So that's a really good question. Or it may be that they're just ignored altogether.
I think Document will be pretty high.
Yeah.
But I think that's a good point. It's like you could go all over the place. For some reason, I think with sort of the crowd that I would expect to vote, that Document will be high. And it'll be higher than some of their other stuff that probably charted higher than that before. And so here's what, so one we have not mentioned at all is Nirvana, Nevermind. And like, I don't, what are, like, that would have been 20 years ago if they did this countdown, that would have been in the top five probably. And I know the last time they did it, it was way up there. I mean, it was in the top 20. I mean, I don't know where's that going to be and where do we think it should be?
You know, that's one that was probably would have been in my top 15 if we'd gone that far. But as far as the XPN list, I guess the thing you have to wonder is, as much as Nirvana changed the landscape of the rock world, back in that day when it knocked off Dangerous from the number one slot on the Billboard chart at the time, which felt like sort of a sea change, and obviously ushered in the whole grunge thing. Saved rock and roll, quote unquote, one of those many times that has happened. But you know, when you think about what the biggest bands right now, I suppose putting the Foo Fighters to the side in a kind of retro classic
a
rock,
literal descendant.
Yeah, exactly. You know, bands that sound like Nirvana and that grew up loving Nirvana, they're really not in the forefront. Now, that's a function of, I think, you know, of the music industry, which is not the same thing as the voting public. But I think it's a very good question because, I mean, I have, you know, I absolutely love that album, but we haven't, you know, talked about it here. And I don't know that as important as it is, that it's as influential now, certainly, as and maybe it would have been at other times, which is kind of shocking when you consider how many albums it sold and how important it was for a long time there.
I think it's one of those albums that people are going to feel obligated to vote for in some list because it does have that sort of weight, and there's enough good stuff on it that people remember that it's going to sort of rank high in some people's minds. I do think that it just had that 30-year anniversary last year, so that's still kind of fresh on people's minds. I guess this year, 2021, it's still fresh in people's minds, so that might have something to do with it still staying high. It might not be a top 20 album in this list. And I think of the XPN voting public again, and I can't imagine that everybody's going for that. And I think it might even, you know, like I'm thinking John Prine gets more votes than Nirvana in some cases. So I don't know if it's going to be too high, but it'll be, I think, a top 50 or 100 album. I would bet top 100 for sure, but top 50, you know, I'm on the fence there.
It's also completely unedgy to vote for Nirvana. I mean, it just seems so, yeah. In some ways it seems so obvious, which isn't fair because that doesn't speak to the quality of the art by any means. But, you know, there's certainly a human element to this. And that thing that, you know, sometimes you get tired of strangely loving the same piece of art for too long. And you kind of say, you know what, actually, now that I think about it, even though I've never listened to anything more than, I'm more of an In Utero guy, you know?
All right, so Chris, you mentioned the 80s and another album that we didn't talk about, the one that I after the fact thought, oh, I should have put this one on my list, and I think this is one that's high for you, is Tears for Fears, Songs from the Big Chair. This is one of my all-time favorite albums, and it's a quintessential mid-80s album, and it has that sort of 80s production style in some ways. Do you think that gets anywhere up on the list? Do you think that albums like that from the mid 80s that have that sort of production value, do you think anything like that kind of gets up, you know, anywhere near the top of the list?
I think it'll be in the top 1000. I don't think it will be okay. Like, I think that's as far as I'd go. No, I think that's quite like, I have a hard time putting this into words, which is, you know, delightful for a podcast, but you know, I tried to get at this in the 71 episode as far as the way that I think people sort of take an album like that and they sort of, you know, push it to the side as though it's like they scoff at it as though it's like it's not something that could have been, you know, released in 71 or 72 and been all that good. And that's just a mistake. And because it is good and it is like it's competitive with so many albums that I think are going to be above it. That are going to be above it because they're legacy artists and because they're artists that, you know, people know one of the singles. So they're going to vote for the album and they're not going to listen to the whole thing straight through. And it's a little bit, it's frustrating. But I think it's a good thing about, you know, I think it's one of the things we're trying to do here at Hall of Songs, which is like, take some of these, pull them out, put them in the, you know, in the context of the years that they came out and try to put that in their place, as opposed to saying that, you know, there was an Eric Clapton album that came out in the 1970s and therefore it had to be good, right? It's like, no, let's actually like dig into it and see if it was that good. And does it compare to some of these albums that came out in the 1980s that might have like 1980s production value? I think Tears for Fears will get some votes. I don't think it's going to be in the top 500. I think it'll be in the top half. And, you know, I mean, I was just sort of scrolling through quickly, but it's like, I don't know, like there's some Simon and Garfunkel albums like Bookends, which is fine. It's good. It's very good. But like you compare those two, it's like you could make an argument for one over the other. But I guarantee you the Bookends will be someplace in the top 200. And I don't think that Tears for Fears will be anywhere in the top 500.
Blame the Boomers again.
Well, it's not even that. Well, it's like, but it's like, again, it's like the, I know Ted and I were talking about this even before we started recording. It's like, there is this, you know, the beginning of the Rolling Stone list, like Jan Wenner decided that Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was the best album ever. And it was kind of like, you know, WWE, where it held the belt and it was up to every other album to try to knock it off its perch. Right.
Bruno Sammartino.
And like, and that sort of is where we're at now. It's like, there are these albums that are at the top, and instead of just saying like, let's take a step back and see, is this really that good? You know, it's almost like, well, prove it, prove that you're better than, you know, prove that you're better than this or prove that you're better than that, which is kind of a, I mean, again, I will posit that rating these albums in this way is silly to start with. But if we're going to get into it, the, like sort of starting from the idea that Sgt. Pepper's is necessarily better than, like, you know, an Elliott Smith album is a weird place to start. Like, listen to them both, decide which one's better, and then go from there.
Well, we've skirted this a little bit in our podcast in the main episodes, talking about how music is evolving in time. And I don't know, I think part of it, the reason why we talk so much about these late 60s and early 70s albums, especially as the greatest of all time, a couple things, but like, it's the golden age of rock criticism, right? You have these writers, you know, like a Jan Wenner, like, you know, writing about these albums as if they are the greatest thing in the world, and people are listening to that and reading it. But also, I, you know, we talked in one of the most recent episodes about how radio is changing, and late 60s and early 70s is the time of free form radio and of album tracks and of people really understanding the album for what it is. It's a listening experience that you sit down and you have an hour with and that kind of thing. And as you get into the 80s, that loses a lot. And you know, listening to songs on an album is more like, okay, I'm gonna listen to the hits, and then there's some album tracks that I might come back to once in a while, but you're not gonna necessarily sit down for an hour and listen to an album. Not everybody does, and pop radio becomes more important, and cassettes become more important. And so catching the song is more important than listening to the whole album as you get further in time. And I think that might have something to do with how we look at these albums, you know, now, and we think that the 70s were the golden age, and, you know, maybe not so. We have plenty of time to get into all that in the main podcast.
All right, here's a question for you. How many women will have albums in the top 50?
It's a great question. I'm sure my strong suspicion would be that it will be a higher number than it was in 2005. That much I'd say. And we didn't look at the full top 50. I know that there's some Joni Mitchell in there. I don't, you know all the way to 50, but I would strongly suspect that there will be more female representation in the top 50 in 2021.
Yeah, I probably a little more. I don't know if it will be much more. Joni Mitchell will have River. There might be maybe Court and Spark or Blue, excuse me, not River. Yeah, I'm thinking of the songs. Blue, maybe Court and Spark. Then you would have Tapestry.
Shouldn't Madonna have an album in there somewhere? I mean, you think about how, you know, how would it, again, you know, an influence, you know, she was kind of a trailblazer at the time, you know.
Well, it's the audience again, and it's also, I don't know if there's a Madonna album that really rises above the, I mean, if I were to pick one, I would say like a Prayer.
Yeah, or True Blue, yeah.
Or True Blue, yeah, exactly. But I don't know. I don't think enough people will vote for something like that.
I'll give you guys the quick stats if you want from the 2005. Madonna did not have a single album in the top 885. I'm going 4.5 albums by women in the top 50, and that is because I'm giving Fleetwood Mac Rumors as a half. There were two Joni Mitchell albums, and there was Lucinda Williams' Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, and there was Tapestry. That was it in the top 50 from 2005. I think I'd take the over on that, but I think I would take the under on 10.
Yeah, I would take the over on 4.5. I might go to 5 or 6. That's probably where I would stop. I mean, any that come to mind that immediately say these are going to be on the list?
I think Kate Bush is going to make a big jump. I think Tori Amos will have several albums on the list. I don't know about in the top 50. I think Madonna will have a lot of albums in the top 500 this time, even though she didn't the last time. I think Fiona Apple will have some albums on the list. Like I said, I think Lizzo is going to do really well. I think Liz Phair will also do very well in this, you know, in this round compared to last. And she was definitely on the list, but, you know, a little bit lower.
Well, it's going to be interesting. I mean, the song list that they did in 2020 generated so much conversation, right, and so much we started a podcast because of it. So we'll see what happens with this one, but it'll be a really fun listen. Should we wrap at that point? Is that a good place to stop, or do you have any closing thoughts?
First of all, just that I think, you know, it's such a fun exercise to go to. It'll be great to listen to the XBN, you know, to the list that they do. And beyond that, yeah, no, I think I'm looking forward to hearing what the voters have to say.
Well, the XPN great 2021 Greatest Albums of All Time countdown begins on December 2nd. Again, we'll probably have this out during that countdown. So I'll just give a plug for XPN right now. You can go to their website, xpn.org, I believe, and stream it and listen live at any point to them. I'm a member. Chris is a member. I would imagine, Ted, you're a member too. If not, it's okay. You don't have to say you aren't. It's going to be really fun. It'll go on for quite a while, and it's a good way to pass a December that's going to be really interesting, at least in my house. And I don't know about yours, but that's what's going on there. So that's that. Our next episode, Chris, is going to be what, 1972? And we have a recap episode and then 72, right?
Yeah, it'll be fun. Like we said, 71 was just stacked. 72 is going to have some great songs as well. So I'm happy to talk about those. You know, go back and listen to our last Waltz episode. I mean, just pretend it's Thanksgiving. Stuff yourself full with turkey or whatever you have lying around the house and listen to us talk about the last Waltz. It's good too.
All right. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Ted, thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure having you on talking albums, and hopefully we'll get you back on soon.
What a pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. That's it for Hall of Songs. We'll be back again with more stuff, whether it's another main episode or something else. We don't know where this is landing in the whole timeline, but it'll land. It'll be fun. I'm Tim.
I'm Chris.
Prove me wrong.